This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com. Hello and welcome to The Testing Show. Today we are joined by a wonderful cavalcade of guests. First off, we'd like to welcome our regulars, Justin Rohrman.
Good morning.
Kurzi Ababa.
Hello everyone.
Gary Heon.
Good morning.
Matt Heuser.
Hey, welcome.
I'm your producer, Michael Larson, and today we have a special guest. We would like to welcome Alicia Jarvis to the show.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. I'm a testing lead at RBC, and I just came back from the Accessibility Camp Toronto.
Excellent. So normally we let Matt run the show as he is the moderator, so I am going to now turn the time over to him and let him do his thing.
Thanks, Michael. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming. Let's start with the news, specifically the Samsung Galaxy. Now, the Note 7 has been recalled, and now apparently a Note 5 has blown up. That seems like a quality issue to me. And what's that about? Any thoughts?
The funny thing was, in the past couple of weeks, I've been traveling back and forth to Asia, and it's been very apparent and very clear that right after when the U.S. Department of Transportation issued that statement saying this device is not safe, a lot of the other government agencies and airlines have really picked up on that. I was in Japan and then eventually got to the Philippines, and everybody, right before the plane takes off, everybody's reminded, if you have a Galaxy Note 7, you have to hand it over to us and we'll put it in a safe place, in a box somewhere. You can't turn it on, you can't charge it. It's very apparent that everybody has seen the effects with this particular problem. It's no longer airlines now, but I've actually seen notes for universities that are banning it, companies that are banning it. There's even a cell phone provider in New Zealand that's actually detecting if you're using a Samsung Galaxy Note 7 and it will block your cellular signal. This is definitely bad for Samsung, and I'm actually very interested in how they would get out of this rut at the moment.
Lithium-ion batteries having strange problems or getting extremely hot or short-circuiting and causing fires, this is not new. This is not something that is only existing in the Samsung Galaxy world. I've actually got discolorations on my thighs because of a Toshiba satellite laptop that in the middle of a flight just got extremely hot on me. I had to make the decision then, and I just unclipped the battery and pulled it out. Pretty much killed what I was working on, but it cooled down and there was a short in the battery and it was causing a problem. Got a replacement battery and never had the problem again. What makes this unnerving, of course, is the fact that these cell phones are with us 24/7. And again, because of the very thin and compact nature of these devices, there just isn't a lot of margin for error. It's a whole different world of how you test these because those are outsourced. It's not like Samsung makes the battery.
There's a couple of interesting points in there, and I think there's a real tie-in to software development. And this may be a bit of a stretch, but about 10 years ago, I was doing a lot of work on technical debt as a metaphor. Basically, people want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to have, get it to us earlier, maybe even with lower defects and all the functionality. When you do that, you take shortcuts that are not one of those three things, and usually it's the code quality. There'll either be defects that don't matter, we can defer, or the code is just ugly and bad and legacy, and your progress slows down because you have to pay interest on this debt. When I started doing research in this area, one of the common responses was to say, no, we're not going to take on tech debt. We want to have our cake and eat it too. We're going to create metrics and measures. We're going to measure the cyclomatic complexity, and we're going to measure the code coverage, and we're going to come up with these percentages, and we're going to insist on this certain high percentage. It just seemed like a never-ending cycle. If you insist on that too, and you measure it automatically in a system, people will find other ways to take on debt that are more hidden, and you'll get crappier code that has good cyclomatic complexity. And my point there with the phones is that the Apple phones kept getting more powerful, but the battery life kept going down to the point that Apple actually makes a little pack. It's a carrying case for the iPhone 6. That actually really is just a bigger battery because the battery life is so short. Some manufacturer kept pushing lithium batteries to be smaller and thinner and tighter and every possible dimension better. And then, bam, there's this huge surprise of, yeah, it does all those things, but sometimes it blows up. It's a result of lazy thinking, a result of I want to have my cake and eat it too without innovation. Iterating over these devices make them a little bit smaller, a little bit lighter. Battery lasts a little bit longer. Sooner or later, you're going to run into a physics problem. Am I wrong?
I would go against the grain of that, Matt, when you say that the question is not really on innovation. I think the problem is too much innovation and less thinking about scalability and maintenance. Mike, you blogged about this, I think, a couple of weeks ago. That seems to be one of the challenges now, where there's always that expectation to innovate. But then as we push all of these MVPs or minimum lovable products, there's hardly any conversation what's going to happen when we start supporting these things. And I think this is the challenge with what you said. You're looking at a very thin battery that is now very susceptible to fires.
Is this really an innovation problem? Is there something that Samsung was doing differently with these Note devices that was just radically different from what every other phone manufacturer was doing? To me, it just seems like another phone that's like the other phones, but this one, its market differentiator was combustion. And that's coming from, I'm not a gadget person. I have a 4-year-old Samsung Galaxy phone, and it doesn't blow up on you. That's one of the perks of never buying new phones. You don't get the cool new combustion features.
Is there something unique and is there something different? I don't necessarily think that there is, especially in the Android world. I think a lot of these phones are put together by the parts that are available. It wouldn't surprise me that numerous manufacturers use the same battery pack. Is the problem with Samsung specifically, or is the problem with the source for the battery pack itself? And if the battery pack is made by Samsung, then okay, Samsung's got something to answer. Somebody's not doing what they should be doing. If, however, they're outsourcing it from another company, what's going on? What else is waiting in the wings that we don't even know about?
It is interesting that we don't have a lot of specifics. Yeah, sometimes it blows up, right?
I actually saw an article, I think it was yesterday, it was by Recode, and they were talking about the problem might have been because of the distance between the anode and the cathode of these batteries that they have on these Galaxy Notes. They know that you're supposed to separate those two, but then it's really up to the manufacturers to be able to create that separation, whatever that distance of separation is. That might really be the cause. It's close enough. They could cause a spark that can start all of this. You're right, Matt. I wish they would get down to specifics, make this like a really good case study on how to not design your battery or components around it, because we can definitely learn from this.
So the exploding phone is the worst accessibility issue ever. Most of the time, most of us do not have to deal with an exploding phone. But we do have to deal with entire segments of our customer base can't use the software. And I think that's what Michael wanted to, it was Michael's idea to do this episode on that, and that's why he invited Alicia.
So one of the things I think it's important, first off, Alicia, I want to say thanks very much for coming on the show and being part of this. I follow a considerable amount of your dialogue and the conversations that you have, and it's led me to a lot of interesting insights on testing, especially around accessibility, and something else that I'm actively involved in as well, which is inclusive design. I'm going to step back and I'm going to ask you to share a little bit about your own exploration and world of accessibility and A11Y advocacy, and tell us a bit about why you are the passionate voice that you are.
Sure. So professionally, I started in accessibility kind of much like anyone else that started in accessibility. 8 years ago, I got a job at Bell Canada. I got it thrown at me saying the CRTC has mandated accessibility. We have this amount of money and we need to come up with some products and services that make sense. How can we do this, essentially? That was my professional start. But it actually started way before that. I grew up in the WARAMS child amputee program, in which I got introduced to technology at a very early age. Just by being an amputee that's missing both arms, I do have hands, but basically short arms. So they would throw tech at me, whether that was artificial limbs, computer at a very young age, all of this stuff to see what worked for me. That whole concept is what really drives my work today. Instead of looking at it from a compliance or a legal aspect. Let's look at it of what technology is really there for, and it's to help every one of us live easier, more productive lives. If you design something, we can design it in a way that it can appeal to the majority, but also take into consideration people that have different needs. If you can't see, how are you going to operate your iPhone or that sort of thing? So that's really where I started. Section 508 and what's happening in the U.S. with the Americans with Disabilities Act, it actually does influence my work a lot, because dealing with different vendors, we're often dealing with vendors that are from the United States. So having a broad view of the legal aspects and what the different legal components are really helped to talk to your various vendors and start the conversation.
I've had a chance to do a number of talks around accessibility. And the way that I often start those conversations is, unfortunately, we start from a point that is not always pleasant, in the sense that we're finding ourselves behind the gun and having to take a product that's already been designed and shoehorn accessibility into it, or it's because we've been threatened with legal action. So there's always something kind of negative that starts that conversation. Not always. And thankfully, once people kind of get on the ball with it and they realize that if you design with this in mind up front, it doesn't have to be painful.
Well, I think that's where the concept of inclusive or universal design really comes into play. For designers and business people to realize that their users are not just people that use a mouse. People who use databases a lot won't necessarily use a mouse. They're power keyboard users. And that's one thing to keep in mind, is that a lot of people, especially now with things like Siri and Cortana, less and less people will be using a mouse. They can use other means, including their voice, touch, that sort of thing. So I think we really need to move away from looking at our users as mouse-only users right from the design concept. When we start doing that, it becomes easier, because your designers will actually design in a way that it's like, oh, at least I know by the design, I know that they've thought about it, even though all the tech aspects from a development point of view and code aspects maybe aren't quite worked out yet. At least from a design perspective, they've thought about, oh, how a keyboard-only user is going to navigate through this, or how a screen reader user is going to navigate through this, or what does this look like when we magnify it to beyond 200%.
Yeah, I think that spells out two very different accessibility testing worlds. One is where you do a gap analysis and do the minimal so that you can pass your audit. And the other one is you actually design for that customer in mind. I'm a big advocate of Three Amigos meeting, where before the code is written, you have the developer, tester, and product owner actually talk about what the goal is for the customer. It's really not new, remarkably not used much. And some companies have actually run with that, and they've added the graphic designer and the user advocate. Clearly, if we design for accessibility, it should get easier to test for it. We'll have less problems when we get on the back end. What's your checklist? When you go in and you're starting to design for accessibility, what are the kinds of questions that you ask to make people go, I don't know how you would do that with a screen reader?
The first thing is to debunk the myth that everything is about a screen reader. Screen reader is usually one of the last things that I test with, only because if you go by WCAG and you test against WCAG, you'll solve a lot of the screen reader issues along the way. With that, my first question is, how is a keyboard-only user going to navigate through this? The other question, especially from a design point of view, is color contrast. What a lot of people may not know is that a high percentage of particularly men have color blindness. From a design perspective, if your color scheme doesn't have good color contrast, you're leaving out a good chunk of your population, including your developers. That's the first thing on my mind. Let's get the color scheme right. Let's take out all the color contrast issues right from the design, so that when it gets to QA and we run it over with a color contrast analyzer tool from a QA perspective, I already know that it passes. It's just a matter of testing it against the wireframes or prototype to make sure they are using the right hex codes. From a screen reader perspective, basically the first question that I sit down and ask the team is, what is a screen reader? Because I think it's important for the team, including the product owner, the developer, the designer, to understand what are we talking about. What we're really talking about is another piece of software that people use to access your software. One thing to keep in mind is that piece of software is exactly that. It has its own bugs, its own challenges, its own thing. To really trust one screen reader to test, it won't produce the best results. So that's really where WCAG comes in, making sure that you're coding to standard code.
My partner in crime, or the guy that I like to refer to as my partner in crime, who's also up in Toronto, his name's Albert Gureyev. Albert and I do a lot of stuff for Weekend Testing Americas, and we do sessions for it. And some of the sessions that we've actually had really good success with are when we discuss accessibility tools, because for a lot of testers, it's fairly exotic and it's like, ooh, hey, this is interesting. What is this all about? There are a number of tools that we can get into where you're just doing checking of HTML to verify that things are tagged correctly and that you've included alt tags where necessary and that you've given enough context to what's on the screen so that you understand what's there. But there was an interesting comment that came up. We were testing, for example, color contrast, and it's one thing to run through and use a tool and have it tell you you have 76 errors on this page. It's another thing entirely to be able to understand what the errors are telling you and what effective changes you might be able to make. The real question is, am I taking time away from the person that is using this product who needs special accommodation so that they can use it? And I also point out that accessibility is not limited to people on the far end of the equation. We oftentimes look at it from the perspective of, oh, you are sightless, so you need a screen reader. Oh, you can't hear, so you need closed captioning. All of that, though, comes down to a deeper question, which is, what is it that you're actually trying to accomplish? Sometimes I go into method acting mode. If I want to really get into the feeling and understanding of this, I will put myself in a situation where I can't hear, where I can't see, or I will limit the use of my arms or my fingers to where, you know, I'm greatly hampered. But I always have to remind myself, at the end of the day, I can take those impediments off and I can go home, with the exception of the fact that I'm getting up there in years and now a pair of glasses readers are sort of essential for me. I can step away from them and I can go about my day. Many others cannot. They don't have that luxury.
Mike, to put specific numbers in that, in the last US census, which is in 2012, there's supposedly one in close to six people that is within the accessibility spectrum, which is roughly translate to 56 million people in the United States. So there's definitely a need. At this point in time, there should be no more qualms about putting this front and center. And I really like how Alicia points it out in the beginning, where she said inclusive design really needs to be front and center. It needs to be part of the conversation. For me, it needs to be part of the definition of done.
And also the disability market, companies are starting to realize the market potential in this. The fact is, if you look at the numbers of people with disability worldwide, there's a market the size of China and it's growing. The thing is, we're the largest minority because every single person is going to be a person with a disability at some point in their lifetime. What I mean by that is that we also all experience situational disabilities. There are going to be times where you can't hear. There's going to be times where you can't see. The most common example of that is in a bar when they're showing the latest sports game on the television. You have closed captioning usually going on there because it's a noisy bar. People can't hear the game, but they can see what the commentary is at the bottom of the screen.
Also, a couple of years ago, when I was first doing the talk on the intersection of accessibility and inclusive design, somebody in the room just happened to raise their hand and said, you know, we've already done a really big push towards developing for accessibility, and it's a byproduct effect, as a matter of fact. And he held up his cell phone and he said, the fact that I can go to a number of sites and they've optimized it to appear on this screen, they've already done 90% of the work necessary to make this product accessible and inclusively designed.
Exactly.
The remaining 10% is taking the rest of the distance.
As a tester, I've actually recently run into a couple of scenarios. So we had a client, a multi-billion dollar company, developing internal software. We had an analyst on the project. And one of her early questions in the requirements gathering was, what about accessibility? And the response was active dismissal. It was, we don't have to do any of that crap because this is internal software for the team. But what if someone on the team had poor vision? I struggled between, we're only doing this because we have to make a government requirement, which is a common attitude. And then there's, it doesn't make economic sense for us to do this. We wouldn't invest that much money for the one team member that needs glasses with, and we're kind of screwing that one team member that needs glasses. We've been talking about the technical pieces, but those sound like business decisions. Gary, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, listening to what you just said, I think the decisions are rather short-sighted because of the market that is not being addressed if a site is not accessible.
To jump in there, I think that, again, goes with a mindset shift on the side of the business and a business mindset shift in that it's been proven that people with disabilities, because of how we live our lives, just waking up in the morning, getting dressed in the morning, doing my morning routine, there are different things that I have to think about that an able-bodied person may not have to think about. We end up to be natural-born problem solvers because we have to be, because the world is not designed for us. We have to find ways that work for us. When companies say, oh, it's just employee-facing, it's just for our team, it's a product that's going to be built in-house, I really like to challenge that because your employees are your first customers. If an employee is not happy in their job or where they're working and isn't proud of the company that they're working for and can't do their job because the systems don't allow them to be the best employee that they can be, I think we're doing a disservice to all of our employees. I would like to think that my colleagues could live up to their full potential just like anyone else. We need to really shift that mindset of, oh, it's internal, it's employee facing, and really think about what is that really saying to all of our employees when we say that, not just to the person with a disability, and really think about it from that perspective.
Yeah, thank you. One thing I would add before we get going, and we'll do the final thoughts and what we're up to. When we say, oh, it's internal, it doesn't count, we don't have to worry about that, you're stupid, you're silly, there's a couple things going on there. I wonder, if you do good usable design from the beginning, could you go faster? Instead of looking at it as, oh, we're going to have this extra testing phase where we have to do all this extra work, could we go faster? Even if you can't go faster, would it help your developers build skills they're going to need later in their career? And the answer to that is definitely yes. The next question would be, what are we afraid of? We're not doing usability, real usability, in any meaningful way. It's because we don't have the skills. We don't know how, and it's scary. And we think it'll slow us down. Those are pretty terrible reasons to do something, I gotta say. That's circling the drain. And when there's a change in the marketplace where we need to find a new job, we will have less skills. I'm not buying it, my short answer. And I think that'll be my closing thought, and we can go around and do closing thoughts. Justin?
I'm mostly interested in the how of accessibility testing. I was working on a project for an agency company earlier this year. We were making a website for a long distance carrier. The things we had to do was accessibility testing, and I was on the project really briefly, and I was presented with what seemed like just a checklist, like the simple list of things that I need to go over. And once the checklist is approved, then the website is officially accessible. So I think that's a lot of people's encounter with accessibility testing. And the stories I've heard today lead me to believe that there is much, much more to it than a checklist. I'd like to see actual, real accessibility testing, like live in action.
Come to weekend testing this weekend.
I will if I can.
I'm going to give a shout out. Strongly suggest looking at the work that the University of Cambridge in the UK has done and look at their inclusive design toolkit. I've been talking about their information for a while, and they actually make physical products because they also test things that are outside of software. The two kits that they have, one of which is a tactile tool, which is a pair of gloves that you can wear. They are these broad bands, and if you adjust them, they make your bending of your fingers harder. The only downside is they're not cheap. They cost £200. £150, excuse me, $200 to get a pair. But what is affordable, and I would strongly encourage, if anybody wants to do this and wants to get a feel for it, they also have what's called a progressive glasses pack. So you put on these glasses and they start to fuzz up your vision. So if you want to see what it feels like to go from, imagine you have perfectly good eyesight, to wondering what it would be like to have to use level 3 reading glasses just to be able to read something. You can stack these glasses on top. I actually did a blog post about this, and I did an image where I took pictures through the progressive lenses being stacked on top of each other. And you go from absolute crystal clear to, oh my gosh, what am I looking at? Even if you don't go and get the physical tools, look at the stuff that the University of Cambridge has done around inclusive design.
Okay, Percy.
One of the projects that I've been working with the past 2 years with the company that I'm with right now is a ton of consumer sites. So you're looking at close to 800 sites. And of the 800, I'm directly responsible for 100 of those. And then you're looking at maybe a little over 100. So if we round that number, you're looking at 10,000 pages that we're validating. Accessibility is definitely something that we care about. But the challenge now is, how do you get to validate close to 10,000 pages on a given pull request? One of the things that we've really greatly relied on starting this year is a tool called PA11Y, or PALI for short. We do understand that, look, just like in testing, there's the checking side of things and then there's the investigation. We do rely on what we deem as experts to help us in digging deeper beyond the actual automated reports that we get. But having the ability to be able to track what are these things that have been plaguing us over time, whether it's the contrast ratio for some of our images and backgrounds as compared to which particular guideline are we actually having problems against. For those of you who haven't seen this tool yet, this is an open source tool that's based out of Node.js. You can play around. And the reports have been something that I've used right now to be able to dig deeper and try to understand what the actual challenges are. So if you're looking for a tool to help you scale an existing project that you have that needs validation on a regular basis, I would highly recommend using PALI. Thank you so much for having me in this conversation right now. It's definitely opened my eyes on what else I need to look into. And Alicia, you are definitely an encouragement and an inspiration to me.
Oh, thank you. Just to add to that, PALI is a pretty good tool. There are several tools out there. A few that I've used and I've started using are AxeCore by DQ, Tenon. Tenon is a little bit more advanced. So if you're looking at from a development point of view, Tenon would probably be very beneficial. There's a few others, Bluemix. I know IBM has an experimental tool, and also IBM has a mobile accessibility testing tool as well. Those are kind of my go-to tools. I know there's a lot out there, but those are the ones that are really trying to get the false positives down to a minimum. A lot of the tools out there may have a lot of false positives and a lot of problems and issues. So those are kind of my list of go-to tools. One thing to keep in mind with tools is I like to say it catches the low-hanging fruit. Don't use it as, we ran a tool, now we're done. It should be, we ran the tool first, now we do our manual checks, and then finally you check with your assistive technology, whether that's a screen reader, whether that's Zoom Text or Dragon or Siri or any one of those. Using an automated testing tool is absolutely imperative, especially when you want to scale. You can use it to wake up and get to the office at 9 a.m. and look at your reports and say, hey, okay, this is what it spit out. Here's my defects I have to look into further. That's pretty much my ending point from a testing perspective, is I get a lot of questions on how do we do this? I think one thing that was said was we often get a checklist. And that's very important to understand that it's not just a checklist. You have to start from the beginning with your user stories. It has to be included from a business perspective and all the way through the project life cycle. So testing is only one component. When you're testing, it's really imperative that you start with your automated, then your manual, and then any assistive technology that you require. And that's pretty much closing remarks from me.
Where can people go to learn more about you and what are you working on? Longtime listeners of the shows know all about the regular. So, Alicia, you have a website?
You can follow me on Twitter at ajarvis728. I'm also on GitHub. I just actually got on GitHub not that long ago. I don't have much up there yet, but you can definitely find me on Twitter and on LinkedIn. And definitely check out the hashtag A11Y, and you can get all the updates and see what people are up to in the accessibility space.
Great. Thank you. And with that, I think it's time for us to say goodbye. Michael will tell you on the show bumpers about how to send us email. We'd love to hear from you. And thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.